Hello and welcome to the hearing. I'm John.
And from Chicago's North Side, I'm Scotto.
And before we get to this week's album, almost said movie there, we have our best of the year list. We do a best and the worst on the hearing, but because we pick most of the albums for the hearing, we don't really have a worst. maybe a special dishonorable mention to Meatloaf.
yeah, that was tough.
But I think that's the only one that I actually disliked this year. Anyway, my number 10, obviously we go in ascending order, Kate Bush, Hounds of Love.
Oh, mine is Gorillaz.
My number 9 is Gorillaz.
Oh, I picked the Ronettes for number 9.
Number 8, Sonic Youth, Goo.
Man, they were, like, I could have done a top 20, honestly. And they would have been on that one. But my number 8's Blur, Park Life.
That was a debatable with Gorillaz. I was really between those two.
You know, Blur, the Park Life had this, it has this lull in the album that I skip over, but the highs are so high that I really do like the rest of it.
I would say it's number 11 for me.
It's a lot like tonight's album, actually.
yeah. Number 7, Bob Mould, Silver Age.
And you know what? I had no idea where to put the whole Mould trilogy.
I just Silver Age for me.
I can't remember which one I liked best, even, because I mean, we just did them all for weeks in a row. My number 7 is Motorhead.
They would be 12.
Yeah.
Number 6, Guided by Voices, Devil Between My Toes. That was a revelation for me.
God damn, that was a good one. I didn't put it in my 10, though. I don't know if I got my 10 right. This was really hard to cram 20 like really good things into like 10 places.
Give me another week and I would have come up with a different list.
I, you know, as you were late tonight coming on, I was changing things around up to the last minute. It's and places and stuff. It's really, but yeah, if ask I had me had, again, it would be different.
If I had had any free time this week, I would have been doing the same.
My 6 is Muddy Waters.
Okay. Number 5 for me, Linda Lunda's Growing Up.
Yeah, that was another one. That was a damn good one. Mm-hmm. My number 5 is Kate Bush.
Number 4, Grizzly Bear, Shields. There, another revelation
God
for me.
Damn,
I love
that
those.
That was another good one. It was killing me not to put those on. Mm-hmm. 4 was Mitski.
Number 3, Lava LaRue, another revelation this year.
I was trying to remember about that one. I actually went back to listen to that one a little bit before going on, and yeah, not bad.
She was solid number 1 up until these next two came along.
Oh yeah.
What's your number 3?
My number 3 is Wet Leg.
Okay, my number 2 is Wet Leg.
My number 2 is tonight's album, Remain in Light.
And my number 1, the one that as soon as I put it on the list and you agreed to review it, I knew would be my number 1 without a doubt. My favorite recording artist of all time, Muddy Waters, Heart Again.
And my number 1's Emerson, Lake & Palmer.
Of course.
Subtitle debut.
I'm surprised Crimson didn't make your list.
Well, the problem with that album was that there's the giant chunk of it.
Yeah, there's some big lulls there. Much like, well, for me, there's one big lull on tonight's album, but we'll get to that.
Yes.
And speaking of that album, it is from 1980, Remain in Light by Talking Heads.
We did an unintentional 1980 week for some reason.
And if you've listened to Zombie Takeout, the suggested title that I thought was going to be the winner, based on a song by Talking Heads, I figured, you know, it'd be a nice reference, but you had a better title. Talking Heads were an American, and I want to punch were because I keep forgetting.
Yeah, you know, it's just, they're never getting back together again. Just accept it.
Trent and Weymouth fucking hate Byrne, and... Harrison doesn't really say much about them.
The story of this album was that they were almost going to break up before doing this.
Friends and Weymouth were on the verge of leaving the band, took a vacation in the Bahamas, I think it was Bahamas, and heard some of the local music and were very inspired.
And they just decided, give it a shot down here. Mm. I think they recorded something down here on Fear of Music as well. But back
to the intro, they were an American rock band formed in 1975 in New York City and best known for being one of the pioneering artists in both new wave and alternative rock. I feel like they were the common ancestor.
Yeah. And this album, There's so much on this album that, like, it just started so much.
Remain in Light is their fourth studio album, just drawing influences from Nigerian musician Fela Kuti. The band experimented with African polyrhythms, funk, and electronics, recording instrumental tracks as a series of looping grooves. Probably my one issue with the album, but you know my take on, loops and repetition, if you've listened to the show at all. Vocalist and guitarist David Byrne struggled with writer's block, but adopted a scattered, stream-of-conscious lyrical style inspired by early rap and the academic literature on Africa. Remain in Light was released on October 8th, 1980 by Sire Records, produced by Brian Eno, and features David Byrne on lead vocals, keyboards, guitars, bass, and percussion and vocal arrangements, Jerry Harrison on keyboards, guitars, percussion, and backing vocals, Tina Weymouth on keyboards, bass, percussion, and backing vocals, and Chris Franz on keyboards, drums, percussion, and backing vocals. They all played keys. Interesting. With additional musicians, Brian Eno, keyboards, guitar, bass, percussion, backing vocals, and vocal arrangements. It's always weird to hear him labeled as an additional musician when he doesn't actually play anything.
Everybody played keys and percussions on this album.
He played guitar, but Brian Eno doesn't even really play keys. That was the whole gag with Roxy Music. He worked the synthesizer, he didn't play with a keyboard. Adrian Belew on guitar and Roland guitar synthesizer. Robert Palmer on percussion. Yes, that
Yes,
Robert
that
Palmer.
Robert Palmer.
Jose Rossi on percussion. John Hassell on trumpets and horns. And Nona Hendrix on backing vocals. Reminder, I don't edit any songs into our reviews for copyright reasons, but on our blog at johnandscotto.com, you'll find links to Remain in Light on Spotify and YouTube so you can listen along if you'd like. Track one, Born Under Punches, The Heat Goes On. Needless to say, nothing to do with the Glenn Frey song.
It was a few years before that, at least.
Great groove on this one. Love that ice pick guitar tone that you hear throughout the album. The slap bass seemed really random at first, but I eventually noticed a pattern.
It's this weird combination of funk and geeky electronic.
And like African music. If you're at all familiar with African music, it was very, influential on this album. Love the shouted vocal.
Oh,
Some
yeah.
great harmonies. I did look this up, but I said I'm guessing the solo is Blue.
I think so.
It was.
They recorded a lot of stuff without him, and then he kind of came in at the end and performed on it.
He got overshadowed by Fripp and kind of became known as a rhythm guitarist in Crimson in the latter version. But he's legendary for making a guitar sound like things other than a guitar.
Well, he was using like a synth guitar on
Well, no, he can
this.
take a standard electric guitar and make it sound like something you've never heard before. It's kind of his bread and butter. Before he got, I don't want to say demoted because I've been always been very fond of rhythm guitarists. I've said that before, but he was basically the rhythm guitarist in Crimson. Kind of, overshadowed by Fripp, but Blue is a hell of a player in his own right.
And sometimes you need that rhythm guitar. Sometimes that is the connective tissue that makes
I
it a
love rhythm
song,
guitar, and Byrne is one of the best.
Blue
No,
or
Byrne is
Burn.
one of the best rhythm guitarists out there.
See, I love the pairing on this where that shouted goes on part and the slower, soulful singing. And honestly, I'm going to make my brave pick. That this is my pick for strongest, actually. This just comes out with this. It's kind of a slower funk, but it really, there's just so much power to it, and they really just nail it here, I think, more than anywhere else.
Then I don't have to ask the question in a few songs.
Right. I'm not taking the coward's way out of this one. I've had enough years to think about it with this album.
And I'm just impressed by how much variety they were able to give these loops with just changing the vocals.
Well, the crazy thing about this album is this is pre-sampling still. So they learned to play the loop. They're physically playing the loop.
Yeah, there's no electronic. Well, there are electronics, there are synthesizers, but there are no sequencers, is the word I'm looking for.
This is just before sequencers. and they learned to play, and they that was the sampling. It's kind of, this is a very James Brown album, you know.
I was going to say Nile Rodgers, but yeah, same thing.
Nah, because James Brown would do this stuff where the same thing with the lyrics. Like, it's obvious that this whole entire first side, there's very little pre-written.
Oh,
It
yeah.
is just Byrne going at it. Like, and James Brown would do that a lot too.
Okay, in that sense, yeah. I was
Where he would.
thinking Nile Rodgers, who got it from James Brown, was he prides himself on being able just to hold down the same groove endlessly
Right.
and flawlessly, and he can. And that's what this album is.
And a lot of James Brown's stuff was, learn to play this and, learn to play that, and just the band would be the sampling machine, like when they did Bowie's for Good Lovin'.
Sex Machine.
Sex Machine. Yeah, he's
It's
just like,
one
I like this
groove
groove,
over and
take
over
this
again.
over. And that's exactly what they're doing on this
Yeah,
first side
yeah.
here.
Track two, Cross-Eyed and Painless. Nice pop rock groove on this one, kind of a little more up tempo, a little more, heavy guitar, lovely guitar tone. The whistle sounds kinds of inter is kind of interesting, like the chorus melody. I'm kind of already tired of the noisy solos though.
Oh yeah, this is where Nile Rodgers' name comes in my notes. I call it the Nile Rodgers on meth riff. This whole first side, the only thing they really do sell me on the concept of cocaine, because that's all I'm picturing is these guys down in the Caribbean just gacking themselves out of their minds and playing this stuff.
Was that a thing? Because I've never heard that in connection with Burn or Eno.
Well, if you ever watch the movie Stop Making Sense, you can see
Oh,
Byrne's
yeah.
eyes are just like saucers.
But
Like,
I've never heard allegations of a drug problem with him.
I
And
don't know. I mean, who
if
knows?
anybody, if that was ever a thing, Franz and Weymouth would have put it out there in a heartbeat.
They probably
They
were
fucking
all.
hate him.
Yeah, they do. But, and of course, it goes with that show, like the performance in Stop Making Sense. He's just fucking electric. Like,
And I
he
think
never stops in
he's
that
just one of
show.
those people, he hits the stage and just becomes possessed.
Yeah, it's fucking freaky. It's a great concert movie directed by
Oh,
Jonathan
absolutely. If
Demme.
you've never seen Stop Making Sense, stop this episode and go watch it. I think you can find it on Pluto for free.
I got to see it in a movie theater once. Fucking fantastic. It was like being at a concert.
Oh, yeah.
It's that well directed too.
Track three, The Great Curve. This one gives me Shaft vibes.
Yeah. I mean, this is where the concept of cocaine really came in. Like, there's no way they're not doing it.
Great bass tone on this one, like the overlapping vocals in the chorus. Finally, a good solo. But at this point, like each song was getting so repetitive that I just couldn't find anything to say really about them.
I get that he uses the human voice more as an instrument, and of course, when doing reading up on it afterwards, finding out that he had writer's block, so I'm just gonna make sounds and then words and then just fucking go with it. He does that a lot though. There's like the song "Blind on Naked" where he makes up a story pretty much off his head. This is the song that has Robert Palmer on percussions. I'm not sure why they needed Robert Palmer to play percussions, what he added to the thing, but there were a lot of people playing percussions at the same time, I guess.
Well, I get the impression, particularly with him and Nona Hendrix, who had quite a career, back in the 70s and 80s, they were just in the studio at the time, and
Yeah,
they
because.
came by to say, and this you see this in a lot of, bigger bands, their associates in other bands, their peers in other bigger bands will just happen to be in the studio or come by, and they'll just play on a track because they're there.
If Friends Returns the Favor plays drums on Clues, the Palmer album of the time, which leads me to think I need to know more about 70s Robert Palmer. I'm
Oh
really
yeah, it's
only
quite
familiar with his
interesting.
80s work.
And it's surprising to see Palmer on percussion because obviously he's known as a singer. He's
Right.
or was known as a singer. He also played guitar, probably keys, but I never knew him as a percussionist.
So having this album, I'm trying to remember if I own the CD of it or not, but yeah, I've listened to this album a lot of times, but I listened to it as either a CD or a single playlist, and it was kind of shocking to see the tracking by sides as an album. These three tracks are the first side. So it's a 17-minute first side, and the second side is 23 minutes.
That's only a 5 minute difference.
Think about it though. If you're listening to this on cassette, that is 6 minutes
Oh, yeah,
of
of
dead
silence, that's
air.
true.
Why would you do that? But they obviously, it was very intentional to have these three songs coupled together and then the other side to be a thing on its own. It's like we have two different albums here. It's really weird what they did.
Interesting you say 6 minutes, because I'm seeing 6 minutes and 25 seconds that could have easily been cut. On to side two.
Honestly, I do.
Track four, Once in a Lifetime, the classic, iconic Talking Head song.
Do we have? Is
No,
this?
no, no.
No!
I
Whoa!
never
Okay.
take the coward's way out. You're the one who is like occasionally weak and takes the coward's way out. I am way too
Ah,
much of a fucking hipster to ever take the coward's way out.
sometimes a great song is a great song, and this, I would not blame you if you took this song because I mean, it's played to death, of course, but it's still a great song.
My toxic trait is that I'd rather be right than happy.
My second.
And I am an inveterate hipster, so I will never take the fucking coward's way out.
My second pick actually would have been Cross-Eyed and Painless for strongest, actually. This would have been my third.
I will say though, it's a two-note bass line, but it is fucking iconic. Tina
It's
Weymouth, among like people who really know, she gets her due. But among the general public, they don't realize how fucking amazing and iconic and influential she was. She is
Kind of amazing
every.
we haven't brought her name up until this song, because the whole first side is her on her back, like the carrying the band on her
Oh,
back of
yeah.
that whole first side.
She is every bit the genius and legend that Larry Graham and Geddy Lee and Chris Squire, pick your iconic bass player. She is every bit as amazing as they are.
Like Eno comes in with the sound, and Ballou comes in with those guitar punches, but that whole first side is Tina. Like Byrne himself, even just kind of, he just, and it was intentionally set up this album. I didn't realize that either, that they wanted to do, instead of writing music for Byrne's lyrics, and since Byrne was blocked anyway, write the music and then may leave it to Burn to fit vocals over it.
But you pick any given Talking Head song, and she is what makes it work.
Just amazing.
Franz, solid as hell, brilliant timekeeper, but he's very much that solid timekeeper kind of drummer. He's not very showy. And Byrne, has his thing, but he just kind of lays it over what she does.
Now, if this was the only song you knew off this album, you would not expect that this was a downshift
No,
from what occurred
not
before
at
it.
all.
But it is. Like the first side kind of leaves you out of breath because it is just so frantic and so crazy and so high. It's what other word you could
You're
call it,
really pushing that Coke thing, aren't you?
Because it kind of is. It's kind of just this embodiment of just be, I imagine at least, that you're just fucking that up,
No idea. I stick with caffeine, but love this sort of twinkly synths in this one. It's easily one of Byrne's best vocals.
I suspect the second side, he wrote more lyrics, like, and prepared more things for it than the first side,
He
which
was
was just.
deliberately kind of going for a preacher thing here.
Yes.
I love how they add more guitars as the song goes along, and that big distorted guitar at the end is one of my favorite
Oh
things in all of music.
yeah, it is. It's just so beautiful, and it's kind of a poppier version of the stuff they did on the first side. Like the first
Yeah.
side, honestly, you listen to that first side, I'm like, this is a prog band, let's be honest.
Oh yeah, absolutely. They were, and you've said it yourself, Prague or New Wave was Prague pop.
Yeah, it was a pared down version of Prague.
Yeah. And
Prague is sprawling and big, and New Wave, they just said, well, let's try to get the same elements down into, well, in this case, 6 minutes or less.
let's be honest, Talking Heads invented New Wave
Yeah.
and alt rock. Like I said, they were the common ancestor. But I just can't say enough about Gina Weymouth and that bass line.
That damn bass,
Two
it's
fucking
fucking
notes.
amazing.
Two fucking notes. And it is the bedrock of the song. It is one of the most iconic pieces of music. You take her isolated bass. How many songs can you say that, like, if you just play someone the isolated bass, they'd
Drum,
recognize
drum,
it?
drum. Drum, boom, boom.
And it's fucking iconic. Tina Weymouth is is an absolute legend.
Like that and like the song from the Tom Tom Club. Oh, I can't remember the name of it now, but yeah, the one they're famous for.
Oh, I was thinking the one I was referenced.
Boyfriend.
Yeah, there's that. In terms of iconic bass lines, it's this and the one I referenced for Zombie Takeout, Psycho Killer.
Oh yeah.
And
Oh
again,
wow.
that's three. That's three notes.
Yeah, that's nuts.
But I think that's what I love about her. And her and Tony Levin both. And Levin makes a big deal of this. It's kind of his claim to fame is how minimalist he plays.
Yeah.
Tina Weymouth, same kind of vibe. She plays as few notes as possible, but the ones she chooses are amazing. Anyway, moving on, track five, Houses in Motion. Love the groove, love the thin bass tone on this one. Nice soft vocal, nice to hear him not shouting for once.
Yes, as each song we hear, it starts going down more. You're like on this crap. Like I don't know why they thought this was a great experiment to do.
I hadn't noticed. Makes
But
the
yeah,
ending make sense, but I still don't like
right.
the ending. We'll
Right.
get to that.
I think we spoiled which one are weakest.
We're both there. Okay, good.
Yes.
But yeah, great horn riff. Love the harsh guitars in the chorus. The muffled horns in the middle that go kind of Middle Eastern.
It's like he's singing a duet with himself in
Yeah,
a way.
yeah. The horns on this one remind me of some of the stuff the Police did with horns. I should say Sting did with horns because he played it all.
Oh, right. This was the one guy they brought in to play trumpet, John Hassell.
Yeah. Track six, Seen and Not Seen. Nice spacey synths on this one. Another great soft vocal. The claps are a surprisingly interesting addition to the percussion. I normally don't say that about claps. They usually kind of annoy me. The story
It's
is fucking wild.
yes. At first I was going to put this as my weakest, and then I got after the second or third listen, I was like, oh, wait a minute, this is something. And with the harmonies and stuff around it, and it just he makes it work in the end.
Track seven, Listening Wind. This is my pick for favorite.
Yeah, this is holy fuck, this song. But honestly, because the way they do the tracking on this album, it was always kind of lost to me until Peter Gabriel covered it.
Oh, okay. That's interesting.
And of course, Byrne, I mean, they did this in 1980. Peter Gabriel did his in a post 9/11 world, which made, I think Dave Byrne said something like to the effect that he had brass plated balls for taking this song to cover. Because nobody else would do
Right.
it.
Love that opening melodic percussion. Great bass tone. Love how they build the groove. Love the rhythmically chanted vocal.
Yeah, this is the one they go full Middle Eastern on, of course,
Yeah.
and that's not an accident, of course.
There's some great kind of bird sounding guitars. Blue really shows
Yeah.
off on this one, and great harmonies in the chorus.
It's so chilling. I mean, it is the story of a terrorist from the terrorist perspective, really. It's these foreigners have come in and have taken our land pretty much, and I'm gonna get them the fuck out of here.
Track eight, The Overload.
Yeah, my pick for weakest too. I can't believe it's 6.5 minutes though, because it didn't feel like it was that long of a song, but
It's a
a lot of
fucking
that could be
dirge.
fade out.
And it doesn't fit with the rest of the album. The rest of the album is nice and danceable, and I can deal with the repetition if it's danceable, but this is just, ugh.
It's almost goth. It's very strange.
I almost tapped out on a song.
Because, well,
I've
like I
never
said,
wanted to
like
tap
most of
out of
it's
a
fade
song
out
before.
anyway, I think.
I didn't put it in my top 10 because of this song alone.
Wow.
I will go out on a limb and say it's possibly the worst song we've reviewed.
Oh, no, I don't know about that.
Definitely one of them for me.
I wonder how much this would have helped if they just went with a traditional tracking, you know? Like putting those three songs together on the first side, yeah, it's like a super exciting first side,
Right.
but you kind of get lulled at the end on the second side. So what I think a traditional album would have had, you know, Born Punches, Under Punches starting the album, of course. I would have put Once in a Lifetime ending the first side, and then Cross-Eyed and Painless beginning the second side, and The Great Curve as the ending of the album. Think about it, The Great Curve, the album ending with that wild guitar solo
Oh,
at the
yeah. That would have been amazing.
end. And it would have been after the Overload.
Yeah.
So this whole fade out that all of a sudden, boom, we're not done yet. Here you go.
And I think it would have made this more tolerable.
I definitely think it would keep people's attentions. That's why we, because I'm thinking like, well, you know, is it just me that and the this hang up with, you know, tracking order? But then I realize no, there's a reason why I didn't really discover Listening Wind until Peter Gabriel covered it, because it was just kind of hidden on the second side after you kind of like zone out.
Up until Napster, sequencing an album was an art.
Yeah.
Like, there was a lot of time and effort put into the sequence of an album.
So I feel like this was some sort of experiment, and I don't think it was a very successful one when they did this track order. I think, you know, the difference between this and an old school prog band is those first three tracks would have been a suite. You know, there would have been bridging material, maybe a reprisal somewhere in the end to make it one giant song to cover the first side. But then you're stuck with the second side of stuff that's a lot lower key and like, you know, you zone out in the end.
But I think that kind of worked for me up until the last song, because that beginning was such a punch in the face,
Yes,
and
it
then you get
was.
a rest.
So the peaks and valleys, I think, I'm sticking with it. I think, you know, you start off big, then you have like Listening Wind as like your second track, you know? And then you mix it up that way. And having like 6 minutes, you know, extra on the first side is just weird.
So, do you recommend it?
Yes, I do.
I do as well, just skip the overload.
Yeah. Like I said, you can easily zone out it because you know what? That first side really exhausts the hell out of you because it is just that energetic.
And that's it for Remain in Light. Until next year, when we'll be reviewing the iconic Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd. We're doing Wizard of Oz on Zombie Takeout, so we had to do Dark Side on this one, on the
You
hearing.
think we should do them both at the same time, like when we're like watching them?
No. I've actually never done that. I have no interest in it. I mean, I
Third
believe
line, or
everybody that they line up, but I'm not
there
interested.
are some really funny things that line up. You don't even have to be stoned to think they're funny. Like on the line, dig that hole, he's pointing into a ditch. I mean, there's, you know, there's just certain cues that really hit really well, and it's just dumb luck, but it's funny as fuck.
Well, you say dumb luck, but I honestly wouldn't be surprised if Waters and Gilmore decided to like structure that.
Nah. I mean, maybe they liked the movie Wizard of Oz, but who would like it that much to
Just as
do
an
a
Easter
secret
egg, you know.
soundtrack?
Well, no, that's more of a Nick Mason thing. Those kind of weird ass Easter eggs. I don't think,
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Waters was too busy whining about his father. Anyway, until then, of course, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you
There
are.
you are.